Hello. I'm making an assumption, which may be wrong, which is that you won't know very much about what's happening in our part of the world. And I thought it might be useful to talk about the English experience, but thinking very much about communities and how a national health service, working with independent and separate local government, has been struggling over quite a long period to make a reality of the links with local communities. And I'm, in a sense, doing the framework part of it. And I think Lindsay, in particular, is sort of putting some content in about an awful lot of the things you can see on the ground that relate to this. I was hearing last night about Vermont and the initiatives there to try and get single payer and to try and get some coherence. And it made me think, in a sense, how lucky we are, but also the problems that we have in the United Kingdom that come from that very luck. Because we're in a curious position. The reaction, and I'm going to ask you to do this, if I just say, please put your hands up in the air and look up towards the ceiling. Thank you. You can put your hands down at this stage. The mood music, if you like, the way of doing things, for quite a time, has been highly centralised. So people on the ground have continued to look up to see what the people in government and in the departments have actually been wanting to do. And we've got stiff necks as a result. The Local Government Association would say we've got very stiff necks. And I think the community of the public health sector as a whole would say, yeah, but there were some benefits in that because we knew where we were. And we're moving into a world that's slightly different. And the world we're moving into, if I can ask you, is if you just wave across the room to the furthest person from you and say hello to them.
Hello.
Yeah. This is the world that we're moving into. But the thing I noticed was you weren't aligned in your waving. You were all waving differently.
Yeah.
And you were waving to a different time and to different people. And did anybody feel left out? I could see that there were one or two people who weren't getting quite as many waves as other people were getting. Okay, so that's the image I want you to hold on to. We're very fortunate. We're a highly centralised state with four kingdoms. And in England, we've had a model based on targets to improve health, which has been remarkably successful in many ways at taking us through the early phases of an S-shaped curve of improvement. But it gets harder as you go further up the S. So right the way across the political spectrum, there's been a feeling that the time has come to let go, to trust people a bit more, to wave horizontally through something called sectoral improvement, and to just release the targets a little bit, not do quite as much top-down. Now, what we've been fascinated with is how does top-down join with bottom-up? And it's been a curious relationship over time. So I'm going to hurtle through 15 years of English experience at trying to make the machine of public health and the machine of government link with communities. The bit that's missing, of course, is you won't hear much about communities in what I'm saying, because there's a little bit of it that is community engagement by central direction. But we're moving into something slightly different because the shock of the financial situation and a new agenda from our coalition government is taking us into uncharted territory. And both Lindsay and I are trying to find our way through with our respective constituencies, the local government field and the public health field, and try and make some sense of what on occasions is baffling to us and no doubt even more baffling to those of you listening to us. So please, if you don't understand a word I'm saying, put your hand up and I'll rewind and try and get to the point, and I think Lindsay will do the same. Okay. Yes, this is just my declaration, sort of. I don't owe anything to anybody. We kicked off with a white paper about the health system, but alongside it was this document, Our Health and Wellbeing Today, and it stated the big problem that we've got, which is that we're improving health, but we're not reducing health inequalities, or not reducing them fast enough, and in some cases not reducing them at all. But even within that, an awful lot of amazing and good things have happened over time. So I want to talk about three phases of, or three types of development, all of which rely on partnerships, intersectoral partnerships, all of which are, in theory, linked to communities and the voices of communities in local areas. Very early on, the previous government created something called health action zones. We asked the minister at that point, what's a health action zone? He said, I don't know, you tell me. And it was creative anarchy. It was a sum of money given to areas that asked for it, but were in the worst situation in terms of the health indicators. And it was used for wonderful creative things, some of which were not evidenced, some of which couldn't be tracked in terms of the impact that they had, and some of which were pure gold, worked really well, and have been carried forwards into the next phase. One of the dilemmas about this was, from the point of view of the people in the centre, who liked to count things in great precision, they couldn't count the impact. They couldn't see the footprints of this. So it was redesigned while it was in flight to be tighter and more clearly linked to targets. And we moved to something that was about a geographical approach. And the geographies that were chosen were the 25% of local authority areas where something like 50% of the health inequality loading was to be found. I think that makes sense. And the idea was that they would develop prototypes. Money would go straight to the municipalities and to the local government groups, not through the NHS, but directly into to them, to develop local prototypes that were to help reduce health inequalities. And mapping the trajectories of change in a number of key dimensions, you could see that there were small and steady improvements, but sometimes improvements on what was happening for women but not for men, sometimes vice versa, sometimes good results around life expectancy, not good results around what was happening for child deaths, which are very low in number but very significant. But what the spearheads did, and the health action zones kicked off, was something about a state of mind that said, this will only ever work if we involve local people in local communities. It can't be done through the hospitals. It can't even be done through the general practitioners, because we have the GPs as the kind of gatekeepers and advisors, signposters into our system of health. But it actually has to involve people in their local neighbourhoods, in their communities of interest. And spearheads have been really, really important, and in many ways very effective, because in the spearhead areas, the partners are absolutely committed to making things work. The problem is that the population figures haven't really moved all that much. At population level, you can't see, or you couldn't see, as much progress from the spearheads and from something related to it called neighbourhood renewal as you would really want to. But tremendous in terms of getting everybody aligned and moving in the right direction. The view of the then government was, things are broken, we've got to take a grip on things, and we will direct from the centre. We'll find the models of best practice, and we'll drive those models into everything we do across the whole of government. And one of the vehicles for that was the local area agreements. And these were for reward money. And they were really disliked by people in local government, because for the amount of money you got, you had to do an awful lot. On the other hand, there was a bit of a surprise, a bit of a shock in the system, when half of the indicators that were chosen were directly health indicators. And when people like Sir Michael Marmot, who's sort of our really kind of inspiring guide, I think, would say to us, actually, all of the indicators are about health improvement. So although we didn't like the system, what it demonstrated was that already the local authorities, the local councils, the cities, were, and the counties were doing really good health work. But it wasn't still not quite taking us where we wanted to be. So we moved on from that into a model that picked up the idea in Healthy Places, Healthy Lives, that if we know what to do, the issue is how to mobilise people to do it. And that was using sort of all of the kind of work kit of large-scale change to take something that is known and try and make sure that it's adopted. But you don't do it by simply thinking of the transmission of the learning. you actually have to get people to do the reworking of it. So the slogan, in a way, was if you don't, you might not have to reinvent the wheel, but you have to customise it for every kind of local group and every place that you're working. It looks positive at this stage. There are about 30 places, not the 70-odd that were in the spearheads involved in this. And the early results look quite encouraging. But the method of working was really to try and mobilise a lot of community engagement and support, but to do the same with the staff across the public services. And that's still ongoing. A slightly different view was, let's just have a look at the main conditions, the big killers, big problems, identify what works and try and get some very short-term wins out of the system. And a lot of the national support team work was around community health workers and primary care physicians, the GPs. And they were showing really promising results when this sort of great wave of financial retrenchment hit. So we had something that was working. We thought the lessons had been learned, and we've disbanded the teams. That really is a tragedy, because at that level, which is the interface between what I would call medicine and community health services, they were doing tremendous work. The next in line from this looked at where the worst of the worst was, and it looked at the half of the bottom fifth in terms of health indicators. Recognised there was a significant problem about those people ever coming near our health services. Realised there was an awful lot that needed to be done about how people lived, but also the conditions that led to them needing that support. So the wider determinants really kind of bore down on these groups. And is focusing through Inclusion Health, which is the title of the programme, on groups who merge into each other around the prisoners, homelessness, drug and alcohol misusers, and then a separate group of migrants and travellers and gypsies. By the way, gypsies in England have the lowest life expectancy of any group, and it's significantly lower than the average. And the third group there is isolated elders and disabled people who are increasingly sort of vulnerable at that level. So it raises for us sort of some really interesting questions about what... Sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but for those different strategies...
Yes. A bit, yes, in that there was a bias in the system towards giving more money to the poorer areas in general, and then specifically the spearhead areas got a significant amount of cash.
And is that
so, it's a very, very complicated area. Actually, they tend not to move quite as much as we might imagine. So the issue is about having in each local authority area workers who will work, for example, on health improvement, but also on education. But it's very vexed because we've got a Secretary of State for our local government sphere who wants to remove the legal obligation on every local authority to provide a camping site for gypsies. By the way, there's a legal obligation, but most of them haven't done it. And they've had 20 years, and most of them haven't done it. And it's a probably our vexed issue at the moment, because there have been all sorts of tricky issues about settlement, people staying in a place without the planning permissions that people in general have to get, and the furore that goes with all of that. But there is no doubt that the government itself recognises the health issue, and there is a new policy document about to appear in relation to gypsies and travellers that will be very helpful. So the left hand and the right hand are working at a different on a different theme. When we look back at this, we've got a number of implicit theories. They're all connected in some way, sort of, to how you involve communities, but they're very different models. We start off with the kind of notion the health of everybody in England just about has been getting better, and what's been happening is the mean has been shifting. And that's been good. But the escalators have been running at a different pace. So the people at the bottom of the pile have been experiencing a gain that has been much lower than the people at the top. So actually what happens is the health inequality widens. And in some places, in Leeds there's one, the contrast was 14 years of life expectancy between best and worst. So there are quite a lot of kind of issues around that. So you can't just rely on general health improvement and the lifting of the tide to carry everybody forwards, because it leaves real disparities. So the next thing you look at is, do we go for the tail? And the spearheads were looking at where things are worst and saying, let's just really concentrate on this and try and get some improvement out of it. And in the areas where they were working, a lot of good things happened. The gains weren't as great as we might have hoped for, but as a matter of course, we were leaving 50% of the people in that worst situation out, because they weren't in those geographies. They weren't in those localities that were in that position. We also had, through regeneration programs, a slightly different kind of approach to this, which had two parts to it. Where there was regeneration of the physical landscape, so to speak, and new housing developments, concentrations of poor people were moved around. And lo and behold, in some places, without any individual getting better in terms of their health prospects, the averages improved. Yeah, you with me? Because you move the people, you have fewer people in more affluent, you have people who are really at risk in generally more affluent areas, they become invisible. Yeah. Whereas before they were more concentrated. So you break up, I think what you would call a project, we would call a council estate. You kind of disperse the housing, move it around a bit, change the landscape. It's wonderful. In the process, you hide the nature of the health inequality. We had the reverse problem there, where you couldn't get the regeneration done, which is that people were working their socks off with local communities to make improvements, and you couldn't see the improvement. But when you tracked it through to individuals, the people who were making the gains moved out of the area, and there was a kind of classic process of new migrants coming in, arriving with a whole host of issues, and the indicators not looking to have advanced very much. So that some of the places that have some of the absolutely the best public health work that we've seen have made the least gain in terms of the population figures when they're measured at that level. But we know that individuals have gained enormously from that. So this is the reason, I think, going through the logic of this, why we're thinking very much that the task is, as Sir Michael Marmot has described it, of smoothing the gradient of health inequality, trying to kind of push the whole line up so that the prospects of any individual are nearer to a horizontal line. And that's a really, really big ask. In principle, it's been accepted, but accepting the principle doesn't mean that the means have been willed by government. But the great news is that something like the Greater London Assembly and the Health Commission for London supporting that, the Mayor of London has accepted Sir Michael's approach. And he talks about the living wage for London, which is higher than the minimum wage. Now, this is a Conservative mayor of our big city who is talking about the importance of reducing health inequalities and narrowing the gap on income inequality. Now, they don't know how to do it, but at least they know it's got to be done. So I think there's real benefit from that, and I think we'd give credit to Michael Marlott, because his skill with getting the new coalition politicians on side with the overall objectives has been really rather remarkable. We don't systematically implement, though, what we know works. And there is a problem about targets after a while. We all get exhausted with them. So there's a kind of change in approach, and I'll just hurtle through. I don't know. Am I all right?
Yeah.
2 minutes? Yeah. What I want to get to is that a lot of our partnership working hasn't worked, and there's good science behind this. Interestingly, some of the science comes from the world of commerce and industry about what happens when you try and get coalitions and partnerships working. We feel bad in the public services, but then we realise actually a lot of businesses can't make it work all that well. And these are the reasons, which are fairly obvious, and they are to do with culture and behaviour. And I won't go through them. But the new coalition is sort of thinking, well, OK, we don't have the money. We don't want this top-down state. We want something different. A piece of jargon is around localism, another piece is called big society. And with that goes a notion of transforming public services, which means thinning them out and making them more efficient. So there's talk about co-production and about communities being at the heart of things and about social enterprises being the way forwards. There's a lot of benefit in that. This is all wrapped around the white paper and a flurry of activity on it, and a new architecture, which I won't take you through, except to say that it places public health firmly in local councils at local level, and the link between that local work and the national body, Public Health England, and the national commissioning body for health, called the NHS Commissioning Board, is actually quite complex. And the poor public health professionals are caught up in the midst of the debate about this transfer at this very moment. But the government has said it won't split public health up from its core parts. It won't kind of, at one point it looks as if it would hive off the wider determinants and behavioural public health from what I would call clinical medical public health. Okay, so I'm going to just take you to this. The Health and Wellbeing Board sits alongside clinical commissioning groups that are to be led by primary care physicians. Clusters of GPs coming together will carry the budget for buying the health services, and they will sit on and be connected to the Health and Wellbeing Boards that will also have local council politicians, public health specialists, community representatives, and people from Health Watch, which is for patients and carers. And the theory about this is that these are the people who have to work together in the partnership, and if you put them into a statutory body, you're more likely, and say that there is a job of work to be done, which is the strategy, you're more likely to get them working together successfully, because the loose alliances that we've had previously haven't been powerful enough. That's the position that we are reaching, and it's absolutely fascinating because it's talking about bottom-up. The whole of big society is about people doing more for themselves, with others, and in co-production with the statutory and formal services. The money is running out. The very infrastructure that we need to make this work is disappearing in front of our eyes. Perhaps not as savagely as it is for you at this stage, but I think we're catching up fairly fast. And we're putting our public health workforce into a new place to be the counterweight and to work alongside the primary care physicians to lever the change. And the big worry is still the magnet effect of the big hospitals, as in Health for All, right back at the origin, sucking all the money in and not having the local services of the kind that you actually do need to have. And what happens with this is that in my area, the people who were better off were the ones who were having the major surgery. The people who were poorer in the area I worked in Leeds never made it that far. They didn't present to their GP, and when they did present to the emergency services, it was too late and they died very quickly. So I'll stop there and just say we're a long way off. I think the glass is half full, and in that sense I'm marginally an optimist about it, but it's absolutely fascinating to see that history. Thank you.
Thank you very much.